Lecture 17, Heidegger on Authenticity.
I'd like to hone in on the notion of authenticity and also describe some of the existential structures of Dasein that Heidegger thinks are essential to it. There's a sense in which what we're going to be talking about is ethics, despite Heidegger's disclaimer. I think it's very hard to read what he says about authenticity without coming away with the conclusion that authenticity is a good thing to have, and inauthenticity is, if not a bad thing, nevertheless, it's inferior to authenticity. It's the same kind of conclusion I came to when we talked about Nietzsche. Nietzsche describes master morality and slave morality as simply two different perspectives on morality, appropriate to different people with different personalities in different situations. Nevertheless, there is no question on reading Nietzsche that Nietzsche strongly preferred master morality, and the way he describes slave morality and herd morality, often in extremely disdainful terms, makes it obvious that this is something to be avoided. Heidegger won't go that far. In fact, as you'll see, inauthenticity is an essential part of human life, and in that sense, not condemnable at all. But nevertheless, I think there is a very strong argument to be made that what Heidegger's giving us is an ethics of authenticity and trying to say that authenticity is something that we should try to achieve. But in talking about Heidegger's ethics, to think in the traditional ethical terms of good, bad, right, wrong, really is beside the point. There's a sense in which the term that I used at the very beginning of my discussion of Heidegger, the notion of feeling at home, is much more central. And the way I would describe Heidegger's project in terms of authenticity is something more like this. There's a choice we have to make, and Heidegger does describe it as a choice, between authenticity and inauthenticity. But inauthenticity, if what I just said has any correctness, inauthenticity is something which is inferior, just going along with the crowd, living only in the eyes of others, just being what other people expect you to be, is, in some sense, an inferior mode of existence. But the alternative, authenticity, taking hold of yourself in this kind of very individualistic way that Kierkegaard and Nietzsche both praise, that's really identical to alienation. And one of the problems that Heidegger has with modern societies, about which he has many very nasty things to say, is the fact that people are generally alienated. They think of themselves simply as individuals. They pursue their own self-interest. And of course, if we think about modern industrial consumerist society, this is elevated to the point of, in fact, an ideology. But Heidegger wants to reject that. So the question that I want to begin the lecture with is the question, inauthenticity or alienation, is that the choice we have? And Heidegger will say, no, that's not the choice. There's a third alternative. And with that, we'll, I think, better understand both what he means by authenticity and how he could, in his philosophy, already orient himself towards the Nazi movement that he would join a few years later. The notion of authenticity, or again to use the German notion, Eigentlichkeit, is taking hold of ourselves. It's thinking about ourselves in a certain way, or more accurately, Heidegger would say, comporting ourselves, behaving ourselves in a certain way. To understand how this way is to be defined, let's look at three of the existential, essential features of Dasein that Heidegger outlines. In fact, he calls these existentials as a way of emphasizing that they are essential aspects of our existence. The first of them is called existence. And here Heidegger is harking back to Kierkegaard with his very special notion of existence, the idea that human beings don't just exist the way a coffee cup exists or the way a tree exists, but human beings have or have the capacity for a very special kind of existence which involves, among other things, appreciating who you are. Not so much reflection in the abstract theoretical sense, but rather reflection in the sense of being ontological, asking basic questions about your own existence. Heidegger says that existence, in some sense, precedes the notion of essence here, that the notion of essence how we think about ourselves as particular individuals and so on, is something that follows from, doesn't precede, our notion that we are, first of all, existing creatures, question-asking creatures, creatures who, in a way, have to take hold of ourselves. It's within the context of existence that Heidegger says, Dasein has possibilities. Now, it's important to explain what he means by this. There's a sense in which acorns have possibilities. An acorn has the possibility of turning into an oak tree. An acorn has the possibility of being eaten by a squirrel. An acorn has the possibility of being stepped on by an undergraduate. But Heidegger would say, acorns don't have possibilities. Acorns are not Daseins. There is no perspective, no first-person standpoint for an acorn. But we always see our world in terms of possibilities. This goes back to the analysis of time, which actually takes up quite a bit of Heidegger's first book, which I discussed at the very end of last lecture. We see ourselves never simply in terms of the present. We always see ourselves in terms of the future, and since the future is as yet unsettled, we see ourselves in terms of our plans, in terms of our aspirations, in terms of our hopes, in terms of our fears. I was at dinner alone the other night while I was on a business trip, and as I always do, I took out a pad of paper and was just sort of jotting things down. And I keep lists. I'm at the age where I tend to forget what I'm supposed to do and so on. So I was sort of jotting down my notes about myself. And it was very interesting. The notes fell into two different categories. First of all, there were things to do on Monday, things to do when I got back to Texas, things to do in my upcoming classes. And on the other hand, there were notes to myself, things I wanted to tell my wife about what I had done. The notes fell into the categories of the future and the past. That was what defined the present. In fact, if someone had said, why don't you just keep track of what you're thinking right now? I might come up with a fairly narcissistic and very uninteresting stream of consciousness. But nevertheless, there's a sense in which even then, what I would be doing would be very quickly recapturing the past. And probably I couldn't do that without already referring in all kinds of ways to the future. Existence is this sense of the future. It is this sense that we have the capacity to make choices. And while I don't want to make it sound as if freedom and choice is an important part of Heidegger's philosophy, and his later philosophy really eliminates most of what the existentialist such as Sartre will defend in that capacity. But nevertheless, in Being and Time, it is clearly the case that existence is, in part, a kind of freedom to make choices, an openness in the future, and to see the future as an essential dimension of time. One thing to note is that Heidegger talks at this juncture a great deal about moods. Now, I've said throughout my discussion of the existentialists that an emphasis on the passions is very often a key to how they see themselves and see human nature. That would be too strong in talking about Heidegger, but I think something along those lines is nevertheless very much a part of his philosophy. I said in the first lecture that for Heidegger, our attitude towards the world is not, first of all, knowledge or curiosity, but it is, first of all, caring. Well, caring might be thought of as a special kind of mood or something that is general to all moods, but our moods here are not to be construed as we usually construe them, as kind of transient internal weather. We feel this now, but I'll be over it in an hour, or I'm just sad right now, but it's not really about anything. What Heidegger says is, first of all, our moods are always about something, as Sartre will later say about emotions. Our moods, in a very clever sort of punsical coinage, our moods are what tune us into the world. So that when Wittgenstein says a depressed man lives in a depressed world, one might transfer that to Heidegger in much the same sense, that our moods are ways of seeing the world, experiencing the world, engaging in tasks. What's more, moods are not simply individual, but they're necessarily shared, or to use a phrase that Sartre likes, they're out there in the world. Moods are, in this sense, a part of our existence, because it's moods that tune us in not just to the present and to the past, but moods that gear us towards the future, and moods that involve ambition, moods that involve hope, And certainly that is something which would be definitive in Heidegger's own time, in the late 20s when Germany was in such terrible condition. And you look this overall picture of existence, and what wants to say is that our existence is our openness to the future, and it's not just the fact that in the future we will do such and such, or even just the fact that we have plans, but our very existence itself is something which is defined in terms of our possibilities. The second existential structure of what will turn out to be a trio is what Heidegger calls facticity. We're going to see this term again because Sartre borrows it directly from Heidegger, and the meaning in Heidegger and in Sartre is actually very much the same. Facticity might be thought of as simply the facts that are true of us. We are thrown into the world, Heidegger says in his very dramatic coinage. And when we're thrown into the world in a particular time, a particular place, a particular culture, a particular history. Our being thrown into the world gives rise to our historicity, the idea that we are born into a particular historical situation and a particular tradition. And as I've already suggested, where Heidegger is going to compromise his own individuality, borrowed from Kierkegaard and Nietzsche, is where he says that what we do once we have achieved a kind of authenticity is we reinsert ourselves into our historicity and our traditions. And this is going to be, to anticipate again, the third way beyond inauthenticity and alienation. The third category here is what Heidegger calls fallenness. Now, this is a very difficult concept, and I actually have some trouble seeing exactly how it ties in with the other two. But fallenness, and the language here is very strongly reminiscent, intentionally so, of the fall in the Bible, the same allusion that Camus makes in the title of his last novel. But fallenness refers to the fact that we fall back from a kind of reflective and authentic position to something that Heidegger refers to as pre-ontological. In other words, what we do is we stop asking questions for a while, we stop wondering who we are, and we just, as the beginning of Dasein told us, we fall back into tasks. Now, as opposed to thinking that this is something hateful or something to be avoided, Heidegger makes the very strong case that this is how we live most of our lives. It is a kind of inauthenticity because we are not taking hold of ourselves. We are simply doing what we have to do. We are simply joining in with the others and doing what they expect us to do. But nevertheless, fallenness is part of human existence. It is to be respected as such. Nevertheless, fallenness by itself, remaining on a pre-ontological level, not taking hold of oneself and asking the kinds of questions that Heidegger thinks we should ask, is in some important sense to be something less than fully human. Although, again, that's not a language which he would ever give us. He talks about authenticity in terms of three different contrasts, and I think this will help us get a clue as to what this notion involves. First of all, he contrasts understanding versus curiosity. Modern science, he thinks, is simply curiosity. Most people, when they ask questions, are simply being curious. They want to learn facts. They want to learn how something works. But there's a sense in which this is a clearly inferior form of cognition. Understanding, by contrast, is really just being ontological. It is trying to ask those kinds of questions that Heidegger suggests are definitive of being a human being. It is asking those questions about oneself and who one is that are essential to gaining authenticity. The notion of understanding has a long standing itself in German philosophy. In the 19th century, many philosophers were talking about Verstehen, understanding, as a way of understanding other people, empathizing with them. And that too is involved here. Because what we understand is not just ourselves and our world, but what we understand is other people too, along with us. The second contrast is thinking as opposed to calculation. And again, one can see here a reference to technological society. In a late essay called What is Thinking, Heidegger makes this contrast all the more dramatic. But technological society, of course, in one sense, is utterly brilliant. And the thinking involved in, for example, the manufacture and development of computers and software is something to be hugely admired, but not by Heidegger. Because the truth is, the kind of thinking that it involves really is just a kind of calculative thinking, whereas thinking, properly understood, is thinking philosophically. One might think here, back to, again, the great German sociologist Max Weber, who at the beginning of the century was talking about what he called instrumental rationality, which he clearly thought was something very dangerous, and he talked about the disenchantment of the world with this kind of thinking. Heidegger, I think, is following in these footsteps very closely. The idea is the kind of thinking which just calculates, figures things out, the kind of calculating that simply tries to get means adjusted to ends and get things done. All of this is very different from real thinking, philosophical thinking. In short, the sort of thing that Heidegger is doing in Being and Time. The third opposition is speech, as opposed to what Heidegger calls idle chatter. And we all know what this difference refers to. If you're in a conversation with a friend, you may well just gossip, talk about the news of the day, chit-chat about fashion, hairdos, philosophical periphera, what this professor is doing or that professor is doing or what they did to a student or something of that sort. This is all chatter. It's talk, but it just fills in time. It entertains us. But true speech, that's something very different. You think, for example, you meet an old friend and you get into a conversation. But instead of talking about what you had hoped you'd talk about, namely the origins of the friendship and how you've grown up together and how you have so much to say and so much in common, instead of that kind of conversation, which can often be very moving and very edifying, instead what you end up is doing chit-chat. And we all know what that difference amounts to. Most of us, of course, spend most of our lives, even those of us who are engaged in the highest kind of thinking and philosophy, actually we spend most of our time just chit-chatting. But we should always keep in mind that there is something else. Chit-chat is not what Heidegger means by speech. Speech is something that is profound. Speech is something that is ontological, philosophical. It is tied to real thinking and tied to understanding. So to think about authenticity is to think about living a certain kind of life. It's to think about living what I think most of us would call a very serious kind of life or a profound kind of life, in which the larger questions about being and our being in particular are always, in some sense, in front of us. But that's not enough to make us authentic. And Heidegger adds to this two essential structures, which in fact are very dramatic, as opposed to the last three I mentioned, and very much in tune with the kind of existentialist angst which Heidegger, among others, has made so famous. The first is what he calls conscience. It's the idea that there is in us a constant reminder. We remind ourselves that we are not all we would like to be, that we are not authentic, that we are just going along with a crowd. And as we are going along with the crowd, there is this quiet voice that reminds us that, in fact, we could be something more, something authentic. Conscience gives rise to guilt. But it's very important not to think here of the notions of conscience and guilt in terms of, for example, the notion that Christianity has often given us, that conscience is the voice of God within us, although Heidegger would not completely reject that. Nor should we think of the conscience, as Freud talked about it, as the superego, basically the voice of our parents reminding us what to do. Conscience is rather something built into our very existence. It is the constant reminder that we are not being all that we can be. And here again we go back to someone like Nietzsche, or talking about Camus, who of course follows. The idea is that the guilt that we feel is not guilt for any particular transgression, or even guilt for any particular omission. Guilt comes simply by virtue of the fact that we are human. And in this case, not so much by the fact that we are reflective, a much more general notion, but by virtue of the fact that we are ontological. We cannot help but ask questions about being and questions about who we are. And when we stop asking those questions, when we fall back into a very comfortable mode of existence, whether it's a comfortable job or a comfortable neighborhood or a comfortable marriage, there is still always going to be this nagging conscience that we're going to have that reminds us there's something else, and you should start to think about who you really are. That doesn't mean you should quit your job or move from one neighborhood to another or break up your marriage, because as we'll see with Heidegger, it's very much a status quo philosophy, despite all of the kind of radical existentialist element. What we find is that to be authentic, to listen to the voice of conscience, to pay attention to that mysterious guilt, is to start to think about your job in a new way, to start to think about your neighborhood in a new way, to start to think about your marriage in a new way. In a sense, taking hold of those and making them your own, rather than simply being in a job, living in a neighborhood, being in a marriage. The second notion here, perhaps even more dramatic, is what Heidegger calls being unto death. It is one of the best known features of Heidegger's philosophy, and of course it's often been exaggerated to a kind of absurdity. The idea is that being unto death has been taken as a kind of death fetishism, and one thinks, for example, of some recent French authors who have really turned death into a kind of cause of celebration, not to mention some rock musicians in the United States. But being unto death for Heidegger means something quite different. It's not a celebration of death, it's simply a recognition of death. And it's a recognition of death as what he says is a necessary fact about us. It's a necessary fact which is sometime in the future, we don't know when, but he says, among our various possibilities, it is our most necessary possibility. There's a sense in which being unto death means living with death in mind. Now that sounds pretty morbid, but let's see what he means by it. First thing to say is that we all know we're going to die. Teenagers know they're going to die, just not for another 50,000 years. There's a sense in which we think about death and the inevitability of death, our own mortality, in an abstract way. We think, well, of course, I'm going to die. All mortals die. I'm a mortal, so I'm going to die. But the truth is, we don't face death. We don't take it seriously. Facing death is something very different. When one faces death, and here I'm talking not so much about the modern way of facing death, namely a very close call in a fast-moving automobile, but rather the kind of facing death that has some time for reflection built into it, even something as quick as, say, drowning. I remember reading a Walt Disney comic when I was a kid, and Pluto the dog falls into the water and is in process of drowning. Of course, he gets saved. But as he is drowning, before his eyes in little cartoon balloons, his entire life passes in front of his eyes. He sees himself as a puppy, he sees his first bone, he sees his first doghouse, and so on. It's a cartoon version of something which we have often heard. In fact, the recent movie American Beauty makes this into the main concluding theme. The idea that in the moment of death, your whole life passes before you. But to think of this as a kind of video biography is to misunderstand what's going on. There's a sense in which when you face death, what you ask yourself are some very basic questions about the nature of your life. You see your life as a whole. Most of the time, we're caught up in particular tasks. We're caught up in questions about who we are and how we stack up. But we don't think in terms of our life as a whole. And we all know how easily we can get sucked into this or that obligation or this or that obsessive task. But what death does, that is the prospect of death, is it shakes us out of this. This is no longer abstract. This is no longer a syllogism, namely, everyone's mortal, I'm mortal, therefore I'm going to die. But rather, it's something very concrete and very individual. Heidegger says that it's death that individuates us. It is death that makes us into true individuals. It is death that shakes us out of our concept of our Das Man self, because when you're on the brink of death, you don't think of yourself in terms of your roles, in terms of your social functions, but there's a sense in which you think yourself just as yourself. In the example I gave, when I said, suppose you were never born, but someone else was born in your place. And I said, there's a sense in which no one, including your parents and your friends, would ever miss you because you never were in the first place. The only one that would miss you, and this is a very odd locution, would be you. You're not there. Well, when you face death, what you face is the sudden realization that you might not be there. And in addition to all the other things you might worry about with death, how your loved ones are to be taken care of, or how your loved ones will react to your death, how you might sort of, you know, manage funeral expenses, how you might look after you die. In addition to all those rather concrete fears, there is one very abstract philosophical fear, and one might put it in terms of perceiving for the first time true nothingness. When you die, you will cease to be a Dasein. The world will cease to exist for you, and because the world depends on Dasein, the world for you will cease to exist. I have a very close friend who was a doctor, is a doctor, and spent the first, 5 to 7 years of his medical career doing something that most doctors don't have the nerve to do. But he practiced medicine in some of those far-flung and medically questionable parts of the world. He was a doctor in Ethiopia, a doctor in Eastern Turkey. He was a doctor on a Navajo reservation in the West. And in these various circumstances, he found himself, quite literally, surrounded by death. But one day, he had an accident while camping, and he was rushed to the hospital, and he was, for a while, in very serious condition. And I talked to him later, and he said, interesting. I've seen people die by the thousands in my life, but I realized there's a sense in which I never thought it would happen to me. And now for the first time, I find myself facing my possible death, and suddenly it's a different way of looking at myself. That's the kind of transformation that Heidegger has in mind. That when you actually face death, it shakes you up, makes you see your life as a whole in a way that nothing else will do. So being unto death isn't the same thing as authenticity, although it's one aspect of authenticity, but it also acts as a spur, a kind of probe that throws us out of our fallen condition, out of our inauthentic existence as a Dasman self, and forces us to see ourselves and our lives as a single unity. That's the sense in which we learn to take hold of ourselves, because once we've seen our life as a unity, and we've seen ourselves in terms of our mortality, then we start making what Heidegger calls resolutions of a profound sort. It's often been complained of Heidegger, as later for Sartre, that this ethics, if we call it an ethics, doesn't tell us anything that we should do. And in that sense, I think Heidegger's right, that he isn't giving us an ethics in the usual sense, namely, make your bed every day, keep your promises, and so on. But rather, what he's giving us is a picture of what we should be as human beings, or what we should be as Daseins. And that is, we should be resolute, where resolute means making commitments, taking hold of ourselves. But what should we do? It's not as if Heidegger doesn't give us an answer. And here is his solution to the problem. Are we to be alienated as authentic, or inauthentic, and in that sense, not living a full life? And he says, once we've become authentic, what we can do is resolve ourselves to immerse ourselves in our own historicity, to essentially put ourselves back into our traditions and enliven them with our newfound authentic self. Well, it's not too hard to see here a possible excuse for his Nazi affiliations. That's what was going on in Germany at the time. So to immerse himself in his times and in his traditions, and immerse himself in the hopes that all Germans had at the time, was perhaps unavoidably to join the Nazi Party. Nevertheless, I'm not going to let Heidegger off. Even if that were true in the 1930s, why continue to support the Nazis in the 40s? Why no repentance after the war was over? Is this simply a matter of Heidegger himself making himself nothing but his own facticity and ignoring his possibilities? Is it a matter of Heidegger's own fallenness and never in fact achieving the authenticity that he talks about. Or, to borrow a term from Jean-Paul Sartre, was it simply a matter of bad faith? That question I leave to you.